Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Biden's announcement today that he is ending America's longest war in Afghanistan and will begin the withdrawal of the 2,500-plus troops beginning on May the 1st and ending on September the 11th, the 20th anniversary of the al-Qaeda attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a planned attack on the Capitol, which was the reason for the U.S. military's involvement in Afghanistan in the first place. Joining us is a veteran analyst and specialist on Afghanistan and Pakistan who has observed this tragic span of history as America fought a losing war from the beginning because Pakistan was continually stabbing the U.S. in the back. And to this day, the Pakistan military's intelligence service's ongoing perfidy has yet to be acknowledged and dealt with. We'll speak with Christine Fair, a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service, who previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan and Kabul, and was a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. The author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba, who speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. We will discuss how Biden opposed the 2009 surge when Obama got rolled by the military, who promised a victory that is yet to come, and how much emphasis on corruption in Afghanistan disguised corruption here at home when 90% of the more than a trillion spent on this fruitless endeavor ended up. With the fate of women and girls up for grabs as Pakistan gets its way with its proxy, the Taliban, poised to take over most of the country, we'll examine how the U.S. Treasury could sanction Pakistan's elite and assess what kind of bitter fruit this victory will be for the generals who run Pakistan. Then, with the 26-year veteran police officer who shot and killed a black motorist with her gun instead of her taser, arrested today and charged with second-degree manslaughter, we will speak with Stephen Schwartz, the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net and columnist for the journal Explore, where he has an article, America's Obsessive Gun Psychosis. We'll look into how and why U.S. police kill far more civilians annually than any other wealthy country, with the most recent data recording 1,099 deaths by police gunfire in the U.S. compared to 36 in Canada, followed by 21 in Australia, 11 in Germany, 4 in the Netherlands, 3 in the U.K., 2 in Japan, and 1 in New Zealand. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Security Studies program within the Georgetown University Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. And she's the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba. And she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thanks for joining us, Chris. And of course, the president made his remarks today. Some of it was quite moving, I thought, obviously referring to his son. And after he delivered his remarks from the White House at the very same place that George W. Bush and delivered his remarks in bringing the United States into Afghanistan after the 9/11 attack, Biden went to Arlington Cemetery, where the most recent casualties of American wars are buried largely from Afghanistan. So we've lost, in terms of dead, about the same number, 2,500 roughly, as the number of troops that still remain there and that will be pulled out beginning May the 1st and ending on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 on September the 11th of this year. Of course, 22,000 were wounded as well, and many lost limbs. So you've been following this war, and you've spent time in Afghanistan with the United Nations. What's your sense of what Biden has done?
So, you know, I'm actually really frustrated. I mean, this has been a war that's been lost on the installment plan. And I say this because, you know, you and I, we've been talking about this war, you know, since it began. And from my point of view, the fundamental problem was that the United States never really had the, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for, gastrointestinal fortitude to develop a policy with respect to Pakistan, which has continued to support these insurgents while at various times receiving billions of dollars from the United States. Even today, you know, the Taliban continue to have their leadership on Pakistani territory. Their families live there. The Pakistanis give them every possible kind of support. And of course, it's not just the Taliban. It's their allied fighters, for example, like the Haqqani Network. So, you know, Americans will obviously dilate upon our own losses. But the biggest losers in this have been the Afghans, right? We don't even know the number of Afghan national security forces that have perished. The United Nations does track civilians, but we're looking at hundreds of thousands of casualties. And at the end of the day, I mean, we could just go back and listen to some of the shows that you and I did in 2004. Without a policy to make Pakistan stop supporting the Taliban, we were never going to win. So I actually find the focus upon the number of troops and what they do and when they leave to really be misplaced. Because what will keep the Afghans safe is something that we've really never seriously pondered. So the first, as I've indicated, is a coercive policy against Pakistan. As soon as, I mean, basically we're handing the murderers in Rawalpindi the keys to Kabul. And the second thing that no one talks about is the finances of this country. The United States insisted upon building the largest rentier state that's ever existed in Afghanistan's history. And it can't even pay the recurring costs, a fraction of the recurring costs, to keep this government afloat. So when that last soldier, that last American soldier leaves Afghanistan, who's going to keep paying the bills? So I mean, I find that the discourse around the troop withdrawal to really be bait and switch, because the real issue is Pakistan, and that's not going away. And then a related and very important issue is the money, because if we're not continuing to pay the bills for the Afghan National Security Forces, they fall to the Taliban. And let's just talk more largely. The United States likes to say that it doesn't negotiate with terrorists. Well, that's what it's been doing for the last 10 years. It's been negotiating with the Taliban, and they're going to get what they want. And they've never been forced to actually hold any kind of popularity referendum, which we would typically call an election. And we're just basically saying to the Afghan government that has fought, right, for the freedoms that it has, to roll over and just let the Taliban march in. And I just think that's just disgusting. We owe the women, children, and ethnic and religious minorities of Afghanistan more than being handed over to the Taliban. I mean, what if we said that to South Korea? Or what if we said that to Japan or Germany? You know, it's just really shameful.
So could you make the argument then, what could the United States have done to so-called win that war?
So the first thing that it really could have done was said to Pakistan, you know, if we find that you are continuing to support the Taliban, we will put every single individual for whom we have such intelligence on various designations by the U.S. Department of Treasury. What does that do? It makes it impossible for them and their families to leave Pakistan, which is something that they very much love to do. They might want to kill us behind our back, but when they need to have open heart surgery or when the generals want to send their kids for an education, they send them here. But putting their money under Department of Treasury regulations would make that really difficult for them to do. And what the United States has always said is that, oh, you know, Pakistan is too dangerous to fail. We have to just keep writing their checks, keep paying their bills. But yet the United States did everything in its power to coerce and compel Iran and bend Iran to its will. And yet the United States has never made an iota of that effort towards Pakistan, even though all of those numbers that you discussed in the opening, largely their death is attributable to the Pakistanis. And, you know, the other thing I do want to raise that's been really quite hidden from the American public is that much of this war has been fought by contractors, right? So there are very few troops on the ground at present, but there are still an untold number of contractors. And there's no requirement to report contractors' deaths. But what will typically happen is that when the soldiers are finishing up their tour and they're going into retirement, you have the defense contractors, organizations that we've heard of like Blackwater, Triple Canopy, and so forth, just waiting to sign them up for this war. And they're coming home just like soldiers are, who are still in uniform, with PTSD, with injuries. And we don't even know the true human cost of this war because there's no requirement to report these kinds of losses.
And again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, who's a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul and has served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center and is the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba. And she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. Of course, the argument that President Biden made today was we went in there to defeat Al-Qaeda after 9/11, and we've done that, and yet we stayed 10 years past the time that we killed bin Laden. So is there any way that there can be some residual force left in there that would be obviously run by the CIA and using these contractors? Could they protect Kabul from the Taliban and their Pakistani backers?
So what you haven't heard me say is that I'm arguing for ground troops to stay, right? I have not made that argument. And in fact, Biden is right. Al-Qaeda was defeated actually as early as 2004 in Afghanistan. I'm arguing for different things. I'm arguing for, since we no longer have troops in Afghanistan, and you might remember early in the Obama administration, I argued vehemently against the surge. And I ended up being right about this. The reason why the surge was so problematic was that it made us more dependent upon the Pakistanis for logistics, right? So I argued the reason why we needed a surge was because Pakistani support to the Taliban was why we were losing. So why would we pursue a policy that undermines our ability to put leverage on the most problematic actor, right? He didn't mention a Pakistan policy, right? He didn't mention what we're going to do to keep the Pakistanis and their proxies from just running roughshod over Afghanistan and basically reimposing what the Taliban had in place. And there's just some really bad history here. The reason why we went into Afghanistan to allegedly defeat Al-Qaeda was because the Taliban had been hosting them. But during much of the time that we've been fighting in Afghanistan, where was and is the Al-Qaeda leadership? In Pakistan, right? So I have just been, just bereft of understanding as to how it is that consistent American leadership, as diverse as Trump on the one hand, Obama and Biden on the other, and George Bush someplace else entirely, could for 20 years not articulate a policy that actually addresses the problem. The problem is not in Afghanistan. The problem is in Pakistan. And he didn't mention it. And then having said what I said, the other sad story of this, and Richard Holbrook said this during congressional testimony before he died, Americans don't even understand how our money has been spent in this country. And so it's easy to talk about, oh, we've spent more than the entire Marshall Plan altogether, which is true. But about 90% of that has come back to the United States in contracting fees. right? So for every dollar we allegedly spent in that country, 90 cents of it came back here through the different contracting firms that were executing those money, right? So there's been just a consistent and considerable amount of misleading in terms of framing the problem set and the tools that we've used to address it. And I'll say even more than ground forces, what rarely comes up in these discussions is actually air power, right? That's what the Afghan National Defense Security Forces require, is access to American air power. You know, we've tried to build an Afghan air force, but we insisted upon them using our weapon systems, which is, I would say, definitionally the idea of stupid. But we did that again because of U.S. economic reasons, right? So rather than having a permanent presence on the soil, I've advocated for a coercive policy against the Pakistanis, continued availability of U.S. air forces, and basically special operators. But the real problem is in Pakistan. I mean, you know, the other person that you should probably have on your show to discuss this is Carlotta Gall. You know, it's really funny. The people who have been making this argument the longest have actually been the women. Mm-hmm. Right. Carlotta Gall, myself, Lisa Curtis. I don't know what it is that is just so difficult for these various talking heads to get their heads around. It's not Afghanistan, it's Pakistan. That's where the problem is.
Well, Biden, of course, was against, in 2014, was against the surge and lost that argument, apparently, with Obama. And I believe
you mean in that, 2009.
Yeah, sorry. He mentioned that he went there in 2014. But he basically, I think, didn't Obama sort of get rolled by the military?
He got rolled by McChrystal. And right. It was shameful, right? McChrystal basically, it's classic DC. And I'm just, you know, I've become so cynical of it because you see this playbook. So they do, in the case of McChrystal, they do some special report. They invite a bunch of people who, as I like to say, give good talking head on TV, right? And that gets played out. They go and they appear in Washington Journal, CNN, everyone else then picks them up. And by having them a part of this process, they become immediate defenders of it, right? And so there were two components of the surge. And of course, McChrystal's interim commander's report, which he deliberately leaked to the Washington Post. The first element was the surge, right? Which we've been talking about and how the surge made us more dependent and more reliant upon Pakistan to move logistical supplies into and out of Afghanistan. Iran was not an option because, you know, the Americans hate Iran. And the Central Asian, what they call the Northern Distribution Route, was not viable because the Russians were at some point explicitly said, you can't use those routes if you're going to move lethal hardware through them, right? Well, if you're going to fight a war, you need to move stuff that's lethal, right? So the second component of the interim commander's report was corruption. And that really is a huge component of this story. But he acted as if, and you know, when I would go and meet him and his staff in NATO, ISAF headquarters in Kabul, they would act as if the corruption was only on the Afghan side, right? But Sagar has, you know, every week I get an email from Sagar telling me how much corruption is actually going on in Afghanistan from the Americans, right? So what was a very careful messaging campaign coming out of McChrystal and all of the boys that were in the tent making this report, who then became a very serious component of the psychological operations that were run on Americans, is that the surge is going to fix this. And there's a meta story, right? Because what the military had told itself was that the surge had somehow fixed Iraq. And if the surge and this new counterinsurgency strategy that McChrystal himself was Petraeus, although it may not be so wrong in hindsight. You know, this population-centric counterinsurgency model, you know, historians are going to have the last word on this, but I would meet these people that were rotating in and out of, that would come into Afghanistan from Iraq, and they were just conflating the battle space. And I would even see T-shirts that showed Iraq and Afghanistan sharing a border, I mean, which just goes to show you the continuity that these two battle spaces were perceived to have had. So ever since then, what has just dominated the discussion has been ground troop size, what they do, how they do it, and where they do it. And this has all just been enormous sleight of hand away from not having a Pakistan policy, not having a policy for fiscal sustainability, and the corruption in which the Americans were a founding partner.
Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Christine Fair.
Parting of the flux from the shadow of an empire. God loves a triumph, an articulate liar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And we're continuing the conversation with Christine Fair, who is a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously served as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan in Kabul, and has served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center, and is the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba, and she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. So, Chris Fair, given that Pakistan has been so mendacious and has from day one been stabbing the U.S. in the back, and as you pointed out, of the 2,500 or 400 and something dead that are buried at Arlington, that President Biden is going to Arlington today to honor these fallen, and along with the 22,000 plus wounded from Afghanistan, many have had limbs blown off by IEDs, the ANFO, and it's pretty low-tech stuff, but all of that came from Pakistan, of course, and you're absolutely right.
All of it.
All of every.
Everybody. Want to hear something even funnier? The Fatima Fertilizer Group, which was a firm, and anyone can verify this, Fatima Fertilizer Group was a Pakistani fertilizer firm that refused to sell to the Afghans the denatured ammonia compound that was necessary for IEDs that they sell domestically within Pakistan. Get this. They then made, you can't make this up, when our former illustrious vice president was the governor of Indiana, they gave that very company tax subsidies to relocate in Indiana. And there was a hullabaloo over it, but eventually the tax subsidies were made. A subsidiary of Fatima Fertilizer Group. I mean, that's just how idiotic we have been.
Right, but they refused the Pakistanis refused to supply Afghanistan with the non-lethal version of ammonium nitrate.
Yep. The very same non-lethal version they sold to their domestic markets, they refused to sell to the Afghans. And it is, I mean, this is just one example of the perfidy, right? I mean, I for 20 years, I've been making the same arguments. And, I've almost come to the point where I don't feel like writing another editorial making the same arguments, because it just doesn't matter. Americans act as if Pakistan is so sacrosanct. I'm unable to understand it. I remember years ago, when the Indians were beginning their port construction at Chabahar in Iran, I said, why is it that some of our NATO partners can't move stuff through Iran? Maybe not us, because of the optics. With the American politics in Iran might seem untenable. But the Italians who were there in Herat sharing a border with Iran, not all of our NATO partners viewed Iran as being more deadly and sinister than Pakistan. And it was a subcommittee. One of the congressmen asked me, and I don't even remember how I contained my contempt. He said, well, isn't Iran a nuclear proliferating state sponsor of terror? And at that time, we had only spent $10 billion on Pakistan. That would be excluding the coalition support funds. So it was still pretty early on. And I looked at him with complete incredulity, and I said, sir, what do you think Pakistan is? Where did Iran get its nuclear capabilities?
From A.Q. Khan, right?
A.Q. Khan. So how it is that the Americans have all the willpower in the world to do everything against Iran, but no willpower whatsoever to deal with Pakistan, and it complicates our relationship with India enormously. Like, how can we tell India that we care about its security problems while we are pandering to Pakistan diplomatically and politically? I mean, and this goes at every level. Like, for example, FATF, which is this task force on terrorism financing. Pakistan should have been on the blacklist years ago. It continues to remain on the gray list. And the reason is, if it gets a blacklisting, it can't get money from the IMF. If it can't get money from the IMF, it goes broke. And oh, guess what? Then we hear, but Pakistan is too dangerous to fail. And, the Americans have to go back and ask themselves, where was Osama bin Laden caught? Was he caught in Afghanistan? No.
He was within, a mile or so of their Pakistani equivalent of West Point.
Absolutely. It's an absurdity of it. Carlotta Gall, in her book, she had it so appropriately titled. She called it The Wrong Enemy. And there's very little distance between her and me. I used to see her in Pakistan. And again, we have very similar personal enmity against the ISI. The ISI beat her up in Quetta a number of years ago. And of course,
ISI being the Pakistani Military Intelligence Service.
Yeah, absolutely. She was in Quetta. She was staying at the Serena Hotel. They were pissed that she was there because, guess who lives in Quetta? The Quetta Shura of the Taliban, right? They didn't even bother changing the name. They could have at least tricked us. But no, they called us the Quetta Shura.
Right. So the ISI beat up Carlotta Gall, the New York Times reporter, yeah. Right?
Then they threatened me, as you know.
Right, to rape you, right?
It was a really weird thing. They said they were going to organize an entire regiment to engage in those activities. Pretty crude stuff.
Is it possible that, that expression, may you be condemned with what you wish for? I'm mangling it a little. I can't think of
right.
it. Right.
Sure.
Could you apply that to Pakistan? What are they going to win here in winning over Afghanistan via their proxy, the Taliban, and of course at the price of all of the educated people and the women? And it sounds like it's going to be a horror show. But what do they end up with? And will this be a bitter fruit for them?
So the amazing thing about Pakistan is that, it's a self-licking ice cream cone, and they really have no problem consuming loads of bitter fruit. So what do I mean by that? So what the Pakistanis have wanted all along, and by all along, this doesn't date back to the anti-Soviet jihad. This goes back to the founding of the Pakistani state, and they inherited it from the British. They had this notion of strategic depth, that Afghanistan should be a place that at the time it was a British territory, but now Pakistan can use to buffer its security threats. So during the Taliban, the Pakistanis got very little from them. The Taliban didn't ever agree to settle the disputed border with Afghanistan. It continued to harbor wanted criminals. And, Pakistan wasn't all that terribly enthusiastic about Al-Qaeda either. Different people had different opinions about its utility. But what it did do was it kept the Indians out, right? And if you listen to the Pakistani narrative, when they describe, for example, terrorist attacks in India, which are clearly blowback from Pakistan's decades, and by decades, I mean their policy of supporting proxies has also gone back to 1947 when the state became independent. They blame this all on India. Like they'll say, a really horrific attack on the Army public school in Peshawar some years ago. And I was listening to Pakistani television in Urdu, and they called this, the exact quote was, "Afghanistan se hokar Hindustani sazish." It was an Indian conspiracy run through Afghanistan. And, the Pakistani people generally believe this canard. And the army promotes this canard because as long as there is an Indian enemy, the Pakistani people support the various predations of the Pakistani army, which leads us to another related topic where apparently the Pakistanis have managed to convince some people in Washington, D.C. that Indian and Pakistani peace is about to break out imminently. And we've seen this movie before and we know the ending. This is just buying time, right? As Pakistan is trying to get what it wants from Washington. So it's, I think as a South Asianist who's been following this her entire professional career, we've just seen all of these movies before and it's tiresome and the endings are predictable and the dialogue is pretty crappy.
So, of course, what President Biden said today in his address was that we've got to look towards the next 20 years of security threats, particularly the rise of China, etc., and not look back at the last 20 years. So one of the things that's being avoided here and was certainly avoided by Biden today is the fate of the, as I refer to them as the educated people in Afghanistan, particularly the women.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of Afghanistan do you think we'll have if indeed the contractors and the CIA can't protect Kabul? Will it go back to what we had before the U.S. invasion, which was the Northern Alliance versus the Taliban?
So, of course, the Northern Alliance was really weak, wasn't really able to territorially challenge the Taliban because the Pakistan was so thorough in supporting the organization, right? So I think it's going to take time to get to the place where the Taliban are able to consolidate such a position of power. So I think the parallel that seems to me most likely is actually the poor fate of Afghanistan post Najibullah, which is to say Najibullah was this Soviet favorite that was made the president of Pakistan, the president of Afghanistan when the Soviets withdrew. And he was able to hang on after that last soldier crossed the Amu Darya because the Soviets were still paying his bills, right? When the Soviet Union collapsed and the residual state of Russia wasn't able to pay his bills, he collapsed. And he spent his last remaining days on the UN compound until Kabul was taken over the Taliban. He was eviscerated, emasculated. His body was drugged through the streets of Kabul behind a truck and then finally strung up for everyone to see upon electrical wires. Right. And his brother suffered a similar fate. And after the death of Najibullah, Pakistan supported various Mujahideen group. I hate that word. They're just murderers. And none of the different vying factions, they may have been competent purveyors of brutality, but none of them were decent governors. And it was in that milieu that the Taliban came through. So I do expect that we're going to see a lot of violence, a lot of contestation out in the periphery, and women and children are going to be the biggest victims of this. Afghanistan's one of the youngest countries in the world, right? And so for the last 20 years, women and children have grown up with the hope that they are going to have opportunities, that they're going to be able to go to school, that they're going to be able to work. What happened during the Taliban regime was that, women were widowed, they had mouths to feed, and they weren't allowed to work. So I thoroughly expect that, especially if the U.S. doesn't have a Pakistan policy, which it won't because it never has, and it doesn't have a fiscal policy to continue paying the bills for Afghanistan. And that's a complicated discussion because people don't discuss it, right? We don't even know how much it really costs to pay its bills because there's so much corruption built into the system, corruption from us and from Afghanistan. But, during this negotiation with the Taliban, it hasn't been peaceful, right? While they're talking talks in their lavish hotels at various global capitals, they've still been killing us as well as Afghans.
Well, mostly women and journalists. Mostly women and journalists.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, if they think that during this negotiation period, when the Taliban actually have the most to lose by continuing to engage in predacious violence, that it's going to get better when we leave, people are out of their mind. And you know, I've met the Taliban. You know, before Corona, I'd go to Afghanistan at least once a year, and you know, I'd meet proxies for the Taliban. They were really clear what they want. They do not want the Constitution. They want the government gone, and they want to be a part of the government without contesting elections. They're really clear. They've never been not clear. So it is just really disturbing just to see how. What's the word I'm even looking for? Incompetent doesn't even begin to touch it. The inability to craft a policy that addresses the problem. And the problem was never in Afghanistan except for the corruption. And there, the United States wants to pretend as if it's just corrupt Afghan officials that have made such a vacuum of governance into which the Taliban can walk. We were very much layers of the foundation stones of that corruption. And if anyone who follows the Guard can see, we're still engaging in corrupt practices in Afghanistan. You know, it's funny. I was able, you know, earlier when I was working with the UN, it was still reasonably safe that we could drive from, say, Kabul to Dushanbe. And I went through the Salung Tunnel, which is just this extraordinary feat of Soviet engineering. A dang thing is still standing. The ring road that the Americans built with a cobbling of different contractors together, that thing's a piece of crap. And the only one who can use it with any security are the Taliban. You know, the schools that we built, all garbage. The irony is that almost all the people that we've worked with in Afghanistan were educated in the Soviet Union, right? The Soviets actually brought people to Afghanistan, people that were literate, were Soviet trained. We didn't even bother bringing people to the United States. And you know what's even more disgusting? All of these Afghans who gave their lives to work with us, people as translators, people who worked on the base, people who worked with us in any number of capacities, we're stranding them there just as we did the Iraqis. And, you know, this isn't a bleeding heart liberal issue, right? This is why would anyone ever work with us again issue? We can sort of make the parallel to South Vietnam, right? The helicopters taken off while we leave our partners behind. But with the Vietnam conflict, we brought far more of our partners here. There have been about 36,000 special visa slots available to Afghans who worked in sensitive positions. Very few of them have actually arrived here, and there's an enormous backlog. So, it is dismaying from just about every dimension of analysis.
Well, just in closing, though, Chris Fair, much of what you're saying, our audience will probably think, well, you know, why throw good money after bad? The history of what we should have done versus what we did is history. There's no way to look forward, is there? Or in the last minute,
there is a way forward, a coercive policy against Pakistan. We save money by not giving those murderers more money. Right? A coercive policy would actually be very helpful. And it would also diminish some of our concerns about residual al-Qaeda, because these individuals also have connections with Pakistani intelligence and the myriad Pakistani terrorist groups, which Pakistan continues to use in Afghanistan, right? So having a coercive policy that uses Department of Treasury instruments to make it very difficult for them to move money, having specific individuals in the Pakistani intelligence area or in the Pakistani intelligence organization designated by the UN Security Council sanctioning committee. We've been the ones holding this up, right? That doesn't cost us money. What that does cost us is people having some sense about them and some political fortitude. The second issue, we are still spending money on South Korea. We're still there, right? Look at how much money we provide to Israel. right? So, I mean, Americans can say, why should we throw good money after bad? Well, for one thing, we're the ones that built the Afghan state. The Afghans didn't want this enormous state that we built. We built it. And not only that, we benefited from the money that went to build that state. So Americans need to understand how much our economy directly benefited from this endeavor. We basically, money went through Afghanistan, 90% of which came back here, right? So the Americans weren't aiding the Afghans. We were aiding ourselves,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So
it's called military Keynesianism.
Exactly, right? And so this is why the way in which this conflict is discussed really infuriates me, because it is truly disingenuous. And oh, by the way, we can even go back farther in history. If we hadn't been so adamant in supporting the Pakistani jihad after the Soviet Union invaded, there would not have been an al-Qaeda in the first place. I mean, Charlie Wilson himself makes this clear in his own book, right? Charlie Wilson, at the end of the conflict, he begged the United States to not just leave a distraught, broken Afghanistan strewn with what he himself had deemed crazies.
Right.
Right.
And that, so, of course, is that brought us al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden.
Absolutely.
So,
and just in the same way, the invasion of Iraq created ISIS. ISIS was not imaginable had we not de-Ba'athified the Iraqi government and dismantled the Iraqi army. There would have been no pathway for ISIS to develop. So Americans, I just have this notion that we can just go around, break countries in a consequence-free environment. There are consequences. And mark my word, Ian, there will be consequences for doing a redux of 1990. There will be consequences.
Well, Christine Fair, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me. You always actually devote time to complicated issues. You don't do 30-second sound bites. You do a public service. I really appreciate that about you and always have.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who's a professor in the Security Studies program within Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. She previously serves as a political officer with the United Nations Assistance Missions to Afghanistan in Kabul, and served as a senior fellow at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center, and is the author of Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War, and In Their Own Words, Understanding Lashkar-e-Taiba, and she speaks and reads Hindi, Urdu, and Punjabi. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how and why U.S. police kill far more civilians annually than any other wealthy country.
He changed his clothes and shined his boots and combed his dark hair down, and his mother cried as he walked out. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town. He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "You're Billy Joe's a man. I can shoot his..."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Schwartz, who is a columnist for the journal Explore and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future, an area of research he's been working on since the mid-1960s. And his latest book is The Eight Laws of Change. And he has an essay in Explore magazine, America's Obsessive Gun Psychosis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Schwartz.
A pleasure to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Stephen. And of course, the 26-year-old veteran police officer in the suburbs of Minneapolis who shot a black motorist with her gun, supposedly thinking she was shooting her taser. It's hard to believe because they're so different. They actually manufactured tasers. They're made out of plastic. They look totally different from a gun. They're very light, and they paint them bright yellow to distinguish them from a pistol. But nevertheless, she was arrested and charged today with second-degree manslaughter. But your article at Explore, America's Obsessive Gun Psychosis, begins with this: there are more guns than people in the United States. In a nation of 330,196,902 people as of Saturday, the 10th of April, 2021, On that same day, guns in civilian hands totaled an estimated 393 million weapons. But the part of your article that I'd like to focus on is the fact that U.S. police kill far more civilians annually than any other wealthy country. And the statistics are absolutely extraordinary. So,
completely gobsmacking. I mean, I'm surprised that people are not speaking more about this, because they are. The statistics are so outrageous. I mean, the United States kills 14 times as many people in a year as Canada, Australia, Germany, the Netherlands, the UK, Japan, New Zealand, Iceland, and Norway combined. 14 times, 1,099 people in 2020 compared to 78 in all of those countries. It's amazing.
And these figures come from, the data comes from where?
They come from the Prison Policy Institute, which compiles all of this stuff based on government reports and data from the all kinds of things. You can go to www.prisonpolicy.org and you can get the killings and get the graph. The other thing that's worth mentioning, by the way, this was the one that I just really, I could hardly believe. There are more gun shops in the United States than supermarkets.
My God. Well, let's just focus on the statistics here.
Sure.
Of police killings by gunfire. This is in 2020. 1,099 were killed by police in the United States by police gunfire. The second worst, Canada with 36, Australia with 21, Germany with 11, the Netherlands with 4, England and Wales with 3, Japan with 2, New Zealand with 1, Iceland and Norway 0, and of course the rest 0. So, well, how does the gun psychosis, the obsessive gun psychosis, connect with police shooting? Because it's clearly, you know, across all of the society, there's a gun obsession.
Yes. Well, this, I think of it as a psychosis. I think it's actually a form of mental illness. But in any case, what has happened is that law enforcement agencies, sheriffs, and police departments clearly are not selecting the right people or training them correctly, because otherwise you would not have these irrefutable statistics that we just cited. I mean, this isn't a Democrat or Republican issue. We're looking at hard data. And the fact is that if you are an American, particularly if you're an American of color, as we have seen just in the last couple of days, and you're stopped by the police, you are in real threat. And so I think what has happened is either Americans are unbelievably more violent than any other country, developed nation in the world, or something is wrong with law enforcement, and that we need to hire different kind of people and we need to train them differently. Because as you pointed out earlier, it's very hard to confuse a taser with a Glock. I mean, for one thing, you didn't mention, in order to fire a Glock, there's a safety, and you have to depress the safety in order to fire the weapon. And of course, as you also pointed out, a taser is bright yellow and a Glock is black. And when you look at the footage of that young man being killed as his girlfriend sat in the car next to him, because they were driving to his brother's to look at his brother's new house, and you watch her wave that gun around for quite a while, it's hard to believe that you would not know that you were holding a weapon and not a taser.
And just to touch on that statistic that you mentioned earlier, in the United States, there's more gun shops and supermarkets, McDonald's, Subways, and Starbucks. Is that right?
That is correct. There are more gun shops than McDonald's, Subway, and Starbucks combined. But the one that really got me was the grocery store one, because there are, in the United States, there's 51,438 gun shops and only 36,569 supermarkets. So it's easier to get a gun than it is a head of lettuce.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who is a columnist for the journal Explore and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future, an area of research he's been working on since the mid-1960s. And his latest book is The Eight Laws of Change. And he has an essay in Explore magazine, America's Obsessive Gun Psychosis. So let's talk about this psychosis and what fuels it. First of all, you mentioned earlier that the police need to be better trained. There doesn't seem to be an excuse for that because police are very, very well paid in this country. They're paid better than teachers are.
Yes.
A sheriff or a patrol officer and a policeman in the United States, the medium average salary is around $60,000. But the highest paid states are New York, where the average is $103,000, and in California, it's $102,000, in New Jersey, $100,000. So why is it that police are well paid but not well trained necessarily?
Well, I can't tell you the answer to that. What I think we also factor into this is that increasingly the white supremacist militia movement is infiltrating both the military and law enforcement. It's straight out of the Nazi playbook. So we have an increasing number of police. You can look at this, at the number of law enforcement people who have been arrested as a result of the January 6th insurrection assault on the Capitol. But we clearly have an association between firearms and these white supremacist, white nationalist groups that ought to be a matter of considerable social concern.
Well, gun control, or now it's called gun safety, is proven to be almost a futile exercise. I mean, even after young kids were slaughtered and blown apart by these assault rifles that do terrible damage to the human body, Obama wasn't able to get any meaningful gun control. And, you know, Joe Manchin and his counterpart on the Republican side thought they had a watered-down bipartisan bill, Pat Toomey and Joe Manchin, and they couldn't even get that passed.
No, I think, well, part of it is this has really started since the Reagan era. And, of course, you know, it's all justified by the Second Amendment, although, A, the Second Amendment doesn't say anything about this. It talks about well-regulated militias. Second of all, the Second Amendment, written in the 18th century, was written for very specific reasons, and it has nothing to do with guns today. I mean, the idea of well-regulated militias goes back to Elizabeth I, who started a militia program. And when they were doing the Constitutional Convention in 1787, the concerns that they had were partly racist, that is, slave-owning states wanted to be sure that they could send armed slave hunters to capture and bring back slaves who got away if they got into non-slave-owning states, and that the slave hunters would be allowed to be armed even if the states passed laws against it. That's A. B, the frontier states that were in the process of stealing the land of the Native Americans wanted to be able to be armed. And third, every one of the founders had lived through the colonial period when military officers particularly were bivouacked in your house. By law, you had to be able to, you had to put up these military, British military officers. And so all of the founders had this experience. And I think it's also particularly important to notice that the Constitution specifically does not establish a standing army. In fact, it says you can only, the Congress can only put an army together for 2 years, but it does establish a standing navy. And I think what we have to look at is in the 18th century, the founders did not want a standing army because of the experiences they had had during the colonial period. And for the other reasons that I cited. And so what they wanted was to have citizens who could have arms so that, and that there would be militias in the states, what is now the National Guard, so that if so, we were attacked, that they would be able to invoke these militias to defend us. And it's also important to remember that at the time, and again in the 18th century, the principal weapon that was used was the musket, the smoothbore musket. And at that time, a citizen could own a weapon that was as powerful as a soldier's weapon, because the soldiers were also armed with muskets. And the idea was that, sort of like Switzerland, citizens would have their muskets, and they would be organized into militias. And if the United States was attacked, that these militias could be called forward. The founders would be appalled at the idea that people were wandering around with multiple, you know, AK-47 machine guns, basically combat weapons. That's their function. That's why they were designed. That's why they were built. The idea that we would have this kind of death rate in the United States. I mean, we have a death rate in the United States as a result of guns that is so much greater than any other country in the world that it's just appalling. I mean, why it is not discussed in this level, I do not understand. But it's clear that this interpretation of the Second Amendment, which really traces back relatively recently for most of our history, this was just not an issue.
It happened under the Supreme Court, under the late Justice Scalia, who changed it, turned it on its head in the Heller decision, where they put the cart before the horse. So we only got a couple of minutes left. I wanted to touch on the more cultural reasons why we have this gun psychosis and this proliferation of guns, and why police kill so many innocent people, mostly black men. You point out that before the Reagan era, in the movies with Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant and William Holden, Rock Hudson, etc., there were plenty of guns in the movies that they played, but nothing like what we see nowadays in these action movies with Dwayne Johnson, Vin Diesel, Jason Statham, etc. It's just gun, and the same is true on all these TV shows, whether they're female detectives pointing guns at you or whatever. They're just guns. So this is teaching our kids that the way to solve a problem is to use a gun.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and more than that, if you look at the television series on like something like Netflix, and you look at the television series, the detective dramas that come out of Norway or Iceland or Finland, or you don't see what you see in the series that come out of the United States. Whereas you say a Jason Statham movie, I mean, he kills about 20 or 30 people in the course of each movie. So, I mean, just think about what would happen if that were actually a true story, that some white working class guy went out and killed 20 or 30 people over the course of a couple of days. We have created a culture where, exactly as you point out, we tell people, not directly, but by cultural presentations like movies and television shows and the like, that the way you solve difficult problems is you shoot people.
Well, Stephen, we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Schwartz, who is a columnist for the journal Explore and the editor of the daily web publication SchwartzReport.net, which concentrates on trends that will shape the future, an area of research he's been working on since the mid-1960s. And his latest book is The 8 Laws of Change. And he has an essay at Explore magazine, America's Obsessive Gun Psychosis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in